Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome guest co-host Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Adam.
You know, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Travis Langley, professor of psychology at Henderson State University and editor and lead author of the popular culture psychology book series about superheroes, pop culture, and health. But first, we have some really interesting research that matters. And this first one has to do with antihistamine and fertility and how these things could be linked. I found this surprising.
So this came from the journal Reproduction. And it talks about the effects of antihistamines, which are commonly used for allergies, and some unintended effects. Their proposition is that the antihistamines actually have more effects than just blocking allergies, because histamines are actually important in many other processes in the body, including sleep-wake regulation, sexual behavior, and fertility. And I think that we know the sleep-wake behavior already. It's a lot of us have experienced that side effect after taking some Benadryl. But this new possibility of affecting fertility is something that has not come to my attention before.
Yeah, this was actually out of Argentina, and they kind of did a review of the studies. So kind of we sometimes call these systematic reviews. And looking at animal studies, whether this is the same in humans or not. But certainly the use of antihistamines are really frequent. All of our allergy sufferers who, as spring hits, know that those pollens are a real problem. And the antihistamines are lifesavers for lots of people. But there's a potential drawback that this research says, which is these may also cause some side effects we don't think about. And I hadn't really thought about that. I don't think this data is like conclusive, but it would say if you, for instance, are having any fertility problems, I would look to see, are you taking antihistamines on a regular basis? And maybe that may be one of the things to talk to your doctor about.
They also say that there's been a decline in sperm function over the past several decades, and there are many factors that are partially thought to be responsible for this. I think that what we're going to end up finding is a lot of small effects leading up to these changes. So if you're working on fertility right now, any small change I think can be helpful.
And I think all of us would say if you can have non-medication ways of dealing with allergies, including getting better filters, reducing pollen counts in your house, getting
pots,
the dust up, neti pots, ways of helping it that don't require medications, it's better. Let's talk about our very next research that matters. I got to say, I was shocked to hear this research. I think our listeners are going to be shocked, and I think we actually can save them money.
So this is a study of pharmaceutical companies and how much patients are actually paying for their medications compared to what the medications actually cost. And they found that a significant proportion of the time, medications, particularly generic medications, actually cost less than the copay.
Giving the pharmacies this incentive, what we call a clawback, kickback element here. So let's give an example. If we were to prescribe, and I don't know it's exactly for this one, but a generic medication commonly used for high blood pressure called hydrochlorothiazide, which is really cheap. Sometimes a year's supply could be $20, even less, maybe $10. But if you file it under your insurance, the copay could be more than $20 over the course of a year. It could be $30, $40. And so this would be an example where it'd be cheaper for you just to get the medicine outright than it is to file it under your insurance. That to me is what was new, and I'd never considered that. Because you think about, oh, my copay is not that expensive. You think it's a win-win, but it may be a win-win for other players and not for you.
And these clawbacks, as they're called, are legal, with the exception of some federal programs. So Medicare Part D is one example. But otherwise, this is something that consumers are unawarely having to pay more than the cost of the medications.
So what I will do about it, I encourage our listeners to do about it, is be much wiser consumers, which is if this is an inexpensive medication, ask how much this medication costs and maybe just pay it out of pocket rather than filing one's insurance. And if they tell you that there's something that seems fishy, then maybe you go to a different pharmacy and ask the same question. This may not be a lot of money for each prescription. It may be a couple dollars, but that's important. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, about food insecurity, something that sometimes we don't really think about in medicine, which is you can pay for your prescriptions maybe, but you can't get food or vice versa.
Yeah, especially as older Americans have more and more medications added to their list. And what we're talking about here, the expenses of those medications, sometimes the choices of choosing for getting that new prescription or an additional meal can be a challenging decision.
And this was research in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, a very prominent journal, of 50,000 older adults between 2012 and 2015, based out of Kaiser Permanente in Colorado. And they found that food insecurity was actually pretty common. More than 6% of those who answered the questions didn't have enough money to buy the food they need. And it was more common among women, those who didn't have a spouse or a partner, those who used tobacco or alcohol, people with kind of chronic illnesses, and people who had most recently maybe visited an emergency room or hospitalized. These are vulnerable populations who we may see in our clinics, but we may not realize that they don't have access to enough food.
I think that was the most surprising part for me, and the most troublesome part is seeing that 10% or more of people who reported food insecurity also reported having poor quality of life, having trouble with bathing or eating or taking care of themselves at home. And so these are the people who need this the most.
And we actually, in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of North Carolina, are working with a coalition of partners around the state on a program to help bring this issue more to the forefront. So really working on understanding better, identifying and supporting those who need more security to food and fresh fruits and vegetables because we may see these people who have food insecurity in our clinic. If we can identify it and we can support it, maybe we can prevent illness down the road. I'm really excited by this pilot program.
I'm excited by it too. I think that it's the chance for us to put our money where our true priorities are.
Let's talk about it real briefly, our last research that matters. It's a study about depression and anxiety in graduate students, and it was published in the journal Nature Biotechnology. Don't know how it got published there, but boy, I think this is important research.
I think so, too. I think that the initial reaction of many people when they see this headline, myself included, having been in grad school, is, well, of course. And the second reaction to that is, but why should it be, of course? What they point out is that 41% of graduate students scored moderate to severe anxiety and 39% scored moderate to severe in the depression range. And this is compared with 6% in the general population, which has been tested previously on these same scales.
Yeah, I found this really shocking, very upsetting. I work with graduate students, and they actually specifically call out the need for mentoring. And it, you know, led me to think and to reflect on, have I provided enough mentoring, enough support? And is there an expectation that you work forever as a grad student? You got to get there before everyone else gets there. You can't leave till everyone else leaves. I think this highlights a vulnerable population. We may not think of them as vulnerable, but they're around us and they're part of our families, and we can do better.
In psychology, there's this concept of the locus of control. And I think basically this idea is that if you have control yourself of the situation versus control coming from other people around you, I think that what this underlines is the importance of allowing graduate students also to have as much control over what they're doing in their program as well, control over their schedules, and helping to give them resources, because when school is stressful, there need to be resources in place in order to help support students going through these stressful times.
Great advice and right on target. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear an interview we conducted with Dr. Travis Langley, professor of psychology at Henderson State University and editor and lead author of the popular culture psychology book series about superheroes, pop culture, and health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Travis Langley, professor of psychology at Henderson State University and editor and lead author of the popular culture psychology book series about superheroes, pop culture, and health. Welcome, Dr. Langley.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, I must say that this is probably our first show ever about superheroes. So you're a superhero.
Oh, well, I try to be.
Well, I think we definitely want to know, and our listeners want to know, okay, what are we talking about here? But before we do that, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in psychology and then kind of all things superhero?
Well, I remember checking a psychology book out from the library when I was in fourth grade because I wanted to figure people out. And I've always been interested in understanding other people and figuring people. And the interest in the superheroes for me was a separate thing. People asking, when did you discover those? We've got a photo of me at 9 months old holding one of my mom's comic books and looking delighted. I don't remember. It's like asking when I discovered the sun. But when all of these things came together was about 10 years ago, a colleague of mine was presenting at the Comics Arts Conference, this scholarly conference that takes place at San Diego Comic-Con. That same summer, I was teaching a psychology and literature course and had my students do assignments and to show them how to do their analyses of literary figures such as Iago and Huck Finn and others. I did the assignments myself with Batman as the example. And so this was on my mind when I went to this meeting of scholars, and I was just intrigued by the things that they were doing and how they were applying popular culture to looking at real history, the real world. I was also just this environment, this Comic-Con all around, that was celebrating interest that might make people feel ostracized somewhere else. And so I knew I needed to take these things that I've been working on and write a journal article about Batman. Within a year, I had so many ideas, I knew I needed to write a book about Batman.
One of my rabbis that I learned from a couple decades ago, a young rabbi out of rabbinical school, his favorite hero was Batman. And he would know everything about Batman. And I just thought, why would a rabbi's hero be Batman? But you probably fully get it.
There's a rabbi, Carrie Friedman, who wrote a book, Wisdom from the Batcave. It's this small book with large print. I thought, well, there's not much to this, but it is full of wonderful life lessons with examples from Batman stories.
And that's who I'm talking about, actually.
Oh, that carries who you're talking about. Okay.
Yes.
He's a good guy.
A good guy in a small world. And I find this really incredible because if one thinks about superheroes in today's popular culture, more people know about them than probably almost anything in the world. This is like universal. It hasn't always been that way, has it?
It depends on how you look at it. What do you mean by popular culture? If we go back to the ancient myths, more people knew about Hercules than knew about, you know, particular politicians. You know, there are myths all throughout the world that would be better known than living human beings. So I'm not so sure it's new. It's just different. Because we have this age of instant communication, we learn more about real people. We learn more about, you know, what the president had for breakfast than people used to know. But we also see so many different forms of popular culture, movies and TV and music and one thing after the other on the internet. So we have many different forms in which we get these. But I think there's been something long and basic about this. People learn through stories. They communicated through stories way back when. They shared ideas. They used stories to explain what was going on, stories to teach, parables. So I think this has always been with us.
You're right. If we go back to the Bible and we think about David and Goliath and Samson and these larger-than-life, literally, characters. But if we fast forward to, let's just take Batman for a second. Batman had complex issues. Batman was not a simple superhero. Is that part of the mystique that there were real problems, real health issues, real concerns that made him more like many of us?
I think definitely. Batman is the human superhero. He's the superhero without superpowers, to the point people will argue over whether he qualifies as a superhero or not because of not having the powers. But he's a guy who decided, I shall become a bat. I shall turn myself into an urban legend, which seems unrealistic. But you look, there are people in the world who do have to use anonymity and who do have to do bizarre things to shake things up. And so it depends on how you tell the story as to how people can relate to it. There are people who need anonymity in order to stick up for others for the sake of their own lives. You know, there are countries which people don't have the freedom to even speak up and say what needs to be changed. And so you're depicting a character. The superheroes came out of a time when people had seen gangsters in the 20s and 30s outsmarting police or getting all the attention, and people wondering, what can it take to change this world that we are in? They're seeing corrupt politicians, and along comes Superman and Batman, rebel heroes. They're not just people in costumes. They're rebels. They're operating on their own set of rules, on a higher set of rules, because you look at a bizarre, complicated world and think, what could it possibly take for someone to fix any of these things? And Batman is so human. The character had been around for 6 months before they told his origin, in which Bob Kane and Bill Finger decided, you know what, there's probably nothing more traumatic than seeing your parents murdered before your eyes. And right there, they tapped into just one of the most primal concerns. We all know our parents can and will die. It is a universal concern. So many of the other trappings, such as him being a billionaire and all, most of us are not billionaires, but that's just to help make some of the toys realistic. At heart, it's about a boy whose parents are murdered, and he decides, I need to change the world.
You know, probably almost every listener out there will have seen, by the time this is airing, the movie Black Panther, which I understand you've seen, I've just seen, and it's interesting because, as you say, the heart of that movie is the murder of a parent. But in this case, the supervillain has post-traumatic stress disorder, clearly, but takes that, and a lot of bad things happen because of that trauma.
Oddly enough, the supervillain is the one who wants to improve the world as he sees it. He also wants to take out and destroy a lot of things, but he wants to change the world. And the hero has to learn. It's like, I want to change the world and take what I have. So he goes about it from a different route than Batman goes. But ultimately, there is this lesson of take what you have and do things for others, stick up for other people. And that is part of the appeal of these characters, that some have vast resources, some have nothing. Some have incredible powers, some don't. But those who have take whatever they have and use it to stick up for others. You know, there's that old expression, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's part of the appeal of Superman, is that here's somebody who has this incredible power, but he sticks up for others. He instead of falling prey to his own power, that he sticks up for other people. And that is what can make Superman an inspirational character. It's hard to see how can this godlike power inspire us to be better people, but he manages to do it.
Your background is in psychology, and we know that has the interplay of the mind and the body. What are some of the psychological dimensions of health that come up throughout your research in this work?
Well, a particular thing that comes up over and over are the issues of what does it take for somebody to stand up and do the right thing. We could use the word heroism. We can talk about altruism. There's a lot more research on altruism than heroism. And there's also research on what brings out the worst in people. And there's been a heavy emphasis throughout the history of psychology on what brings out the worst in people and the abnormal side of things, to the neglect of looking at what's normal and healthy, an area of psychology called positive psychology in the last 20 years, started by Martin Seligman, said, yes, we do still need to look at the worst, but we also need to look at what's good and healthy. Wonder Woman's creator, Dr. William Moulton Marston, was saying that when he was writing, you know, back in the 20s and 30s. He was a psychologist, and he was saying that the field focused too heavily on what was negative, and we need to start looking at what's positive and healthy. And we look at many different areas of psychology. We look at examples of mental illness in fictional characters, examples of post-traumatic stress disorder repeatedly, but also post-traumatic growth, people who go through trauma and probably experienced some symptoms of PTSD, maybe even for a while the full set, but emerge from it growing and finding their purpose in life, what's known as post-traumatic growth. So that all these different stories, we can hit these many different things, but those issues of good and evil, though we kind of shy away from those words in psychology, but that is what keeps coming up over and over.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking this really fascinating conversation with Dr. Travis Langley, professor of psychology at Henderson State University, about superheroes, pop culture, and health. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we've been talking with Dr. Travis Langley, professor of psychology at Henderson State University, about superheroes, pop culture, and health. And right before the break, Dr. Langley, you started describing post-traumatic rebuilding, the hope that it gives these superheroes. You teach at a university. How do you teach about these concepts? And tell us a little bit also about your research.
At the university, I teach a variety of different classes. I teach social psychology, forensic psychology. Every spring, I teach some media-related class. The earliest had been psychology and literature, but it's also been psychology and film. Going through these films or these books and old stories and looking at not just examples of mental illness, but things that fit any area of psychology whatsoever, stages of development, personality. And in those specific media-related classes, students sign up knowing this is what they're getting into. In other classes, it's a bit trickier because these days, students have so many different options for the entertainment that it's hard to know what one media example they will all know. I can refer to Batman. They all know what Batman is. I'm not going to go too far because I can also see them going, oh, there he's going into Batman again. But one of the examples I had used of a Jungian archetype, talking about the shadow archetype and how somebody has to embrace the shadow and face their own worst qualities and make them part of their strengths, according to Jung. And I'd use Batman as an example and the Joker as a trickster archetype. This was before I was really doing these things regularly. And some students understood those archetypes better than they had with any other examples. In terms of research, back when I went to that first Comic-Con and I was seeing those comic scholars talk, there was one in particular, Neil Cohn, who was talking about some empirical research he had done on how people read. Some of it has been with MRI research, but he also had surveys that he'd done at the convention. I thought, oh, that is interesting. And I took groups of students for the next 2 years to San Diego Comic-Con and New York Comic-Con, and we'd administered personality inventories. Had people rate themselves and favorite superheroes and villains on a variety of different personality dimensions, looking at things such as how much hope they have for the future. And one thing we found was that in those environments that celebrate their interest, they felt more optimistic and showed higher self-esteem than when we surveyed them, you know, 2 months later when they were at home in their other environments. So in those environments, it boosted their self-esteem and self-concept and hope for the future.
Naturally, this is really interesting because you talk about not only the impact on learning and the impact on audiences, but what about the impact on even the actors themselves? And I am thinking about the Batman series and the Joker and Heath Ledger and playing these characters. How do we unwrap these things?
Yeah, it can be difficult. Different roles exert different stresses. Apparently, playing the Joker takes a toll on people, other than Cesar Romero. I did a convention panel in 2009 where I brought together Jerry Robinson, the creator of the Joker, Michael Uslan, producer of the movies, and Adam West. And we talked about how playing these parts can affect the actors. And it's hard to say. We know that Jack Nicholson had said that he had trouble sleeping when he was playing the Joker, and he'd even warned Heath Ledger of that, and Heath Ledger had great trouble sleeping when he was playing the Joker, and some of the medications he started taking then were part of what killed him eventually. And Jared Leto
It may just be his own personality that was involved in his bizarre behavior while he was playing the Joker. Cesar Romero had no trouble with the role. That was the light, campy Batman of way back when. And when I brought that up about Nicholson and Ledger having trouble sleeping, you know, Adam West simply said, oh, Cesar never had any trouble sleeping. You know, he would sleep while they were working on him in the makeup chair. It's hard to know what a character like that affects someone, how it affects someone. But that's the same with many other roles. You hear about actors who take physical and mental tolls. Christian Bale, a role that he had had right before Batman, had taken a great physical toll on him and mental. It was exhausting. Others get affected in a lot of different ways. So it's hard to argue that it's unique to superheroes or supervillains. One thing you do hear about from different actors who've played these roles, that even as hard as it is at times, the ones playing the heroes, they still get to be those heroes. They'll always have people looking up to them, kids excited to see them and see, here's somebody who represents that hero. And it makes them feel obligated to, you know, live better lives. George Reeves, when he played Superman back in the 50s, he decided, you know, I need to not smoke in public. I need to not curse in public because these kids see me as an example. So from what we know, their consciousness of the roles seems to make them publicly behave a little better, but that's a pretty limited effect.
There was an interesting bit of research recently from researchers at University of Maryland, I believe. They had 180 students do different tasks, including some very boring tasks, and a group of the kids between ages 4 and 6, this age students, when they were dressed as Batman, they worked harder. And this fits into what's known with a lot of different effects of role-playing research, costume research, effects of mask and clothing, the way we dress, the way it affects the way we act.
You also talk about how those who look and read so much fiction and perhaps are looking at these superheroes also learn empathy. How does that work?
Yeah, there actually is quite a bit of research suggesting that people who read a lot develop greater empathy, become more empathetic, even in the short term. It seems to have to do with getting into the perspective of these characters. Feeling for them gets them a bit more primed in the short run or in the habit in the long run of thinking outside their own point of view and outside their own feelings. Someone can feel empathy for a fictional character that if they saw someone behaving the same way in real life, they might not feel for them at all. But when the story has already put you into that individual's perspective, you start looking at the world from other people's point of view.
Really interesting. And the converse of that, of course, would be things that are not really good. And I guess, you know, given the knowledge that video games and other sorts of things that sometimes have lots of violence, that there's emulation. Is there any concern from your work that the villains are sometimes emulated and that any of their, not necessarily the mass violence, but some of the violence that we see in society sometimes could be made worse by these things?
Well, a lot of people bring it up, and there's a lot of logic to it. You think of stimulus response training. But in terms of empirical research, it really hasn't been confirmed. When you want to use an argument that violent video games might foster violent crimes, what would we look at? Well, you see if you look at a correlation, of course, it is just a correlation. If you look at the correlation between violent video game sales and violent crime rates are down when violent video game sales are up. Who knows why? That's just a correlation. You can have other factors entirely. It's a very difficult thing to study. If you hypothesize that this game will make somebody more violent and turn them more sociopathic, well, that's not an ethical study to conduct.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I guess if you're playing video games a lot, you probably don't have time.
No, and that could be a good thing.
That could be a good thing. Let me ask one last kind of question here. You talk about the audience or the fandom. What happens to us when we enjoy a superhero tale? What's it work psychologically?
What happens to us when we're enjoying a superhero tale? What's happening to us when we're enjoying stories of anyone standing up and doing the right thing? It seems to inspire some optimism,
it helps us mentally rehearse the steps of going through and doing the right thing. One of the things that's been found through heroism research and altruism research is that people need to be mentally prepared to step up and do the right thing. And people who've mentally rehearsed it and thought through, what would I do in such a scenario, are more likely to step up and do the right thing. Likewise, with people reading heroic fiction, they're more mentally prepared to stand up for others, to take the heroic step, to, you know, shield someone else.
Well, I want to really thank you for your research. I think it's really fascinating. And since you are one of the 10 most popular psychologists, and I think you have over 100,000 followers on Twitter, what's it like to be a psychology superhero?
Well, I try not to think of that way. It is, once in a while, I will meet somebody who is awestruck to meet me, and that's just weird to me. It's nice to know that there are people who are interested in these things that I'm interested in, and people who want to look at some of the things I want to look at.
Well, I think that the superhero mindset is certainly here to stay, and it's always been here. And I think the analysis of those by Travis Langley, author of multiple books, including Batman in Psychology and The Walking Dead Psychology and Star Wars Psychology, I think we can get the picture. Just want to thank you for being a guest on Your Health and sharing your passion and insights that can help us all really think through this better.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed this.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Jonathan and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Jonathan, a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show. They can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone who is older and lives alone.
My mother's 87 years old and she lives alone. I'd like to hire a home health care provider to help her with some of the day-to-day management of her health and her household. Do you have any suggestions on how to find the right person for the job?
We really appreciate you bringing this question and concern forward, because this is not a situation you're alone with. That's an issue of an aging society, that people do want to be independent, but a lot of them are living alone. Their spouse, if they were married, may have passed away.
Oftentimes, the responsibility falls onto family members themselves who are already strapped thin with their own responsibilities and don't necessarily have the experience or the time to be able to handle these things on their own. So this is, like you said, Adam, is an extremely common issue that people come up with, and everybody just wants the best for their family here.
In terms of a home health care provider, there are several options. And when my mother was at this age, we actually had to hire a home care provider. Now, notice I said a home care provider rather than a home health care provider. You may need a nurse or a medical assistant or somewhere in between those, but you may not. You may just need someone who actually specializes in home care, who certainly has a sensitivity. They may have some background, some exposure to health care. But what they really need to do is have really good judgment, really good communication skills, things that are really underappreciated but essential if they're going to be spending 8, 10, 12 hours a day with your mother or father.
Sometimes the best is word-of-mouth recommendations, knowing somebody else who's had a similar situation in your area who might have an organization or a specific individual that they can recommend. Certainly, your family doctor would have a lot of knowledge of similar patients and families who have had to find home assistance of some sort or another and can help you with some guidance there as well.
And we have social workers who many times know more than the providers will know about these kinds of questions. But I'll tell you, as a consumer, having been through this myself, you need to interview. You need to be an advocate. You need to understand that it may not just be a person. You may be having a relationship with an agency. What happens when it snows? What happens when the next person doesn't come on at night and they're alone? What happens when there's something happening? Is that person going to call you? This is going to be someone that may be part of your family. And so you would want to treat it just like you would with a new family member in terms of really understanding and recognizing that this is critical. And your mother should be really part of this discussion. Let her really, because it's got to be a good fit, just like a doctor, a patient, a therapist, and a patient. It's got to be a good fit with an aide and an elderly person. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 46-year-old woman, and my doctor recently identified a few fibroid cysts in my uterus. She explained my options, and I'm considering a hysterectomy. What do you generally advise patients to do when considering a surgery like this?
I always like to tell people about the full spectrum of options, that a hysterectomy is an option, but it is not the only option as well. And that the hysterectomy recovery time does take a little bit out of you. That takes a little bit of time if, depending on how your life schedule is at the moment. Maybe that's something that factors in is, do I have time to go through a recovery right now and get back up to strength?
You know, I think at one time in our medical history 10, 20 years ago, we might have just assumed that people were going to go in for hysterectomy. But, you know, in this particular case, maybe there are no symptoms, so in which case you don't need to do anything. Maybe the symptoms are manageable. Maybe you can take medication hormonally. Maybe you can have an injection. Maybe you can have a partial excision. Short of hysterectomy, hysterectomy is kind of a radical procedure. It may need to be done, but you're 46. Maybe you want to get pregnant again. Maybe you want to not have to be on hormones. So I think this is a complicated question, but I certainly would start with your primary care physician, start with your OBGYN, and look at all your options.
I agree. There are certain procedures that I think we've come to think of as a rite of passage, getting your wisdom teeth out, getting your tonsils out, or having a hysterectomy. And more we're learning a nuance to this approach, that this is not a one-size-fits-all treatment.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
I've been experiencing consistent vertigo for a few weeks now. It's not constant, but it does happen at least once every day or so. What could be causing it, and should I see my doctor?
It's a really complicated but really common issue.
My goal is always to get the person to describe the vertigo. Is it your room is spinning, or is it this sort of feeling of tunnel vision with tingling lips, tingling fingers? And that sort of compartmentalizes it in two directions for me, whether I'm thinking with this room spinning of an inner ear problem versus this sort of tunnel vision and tingling lips, thinking more of a presyncopal feeling or a feeling of that you might be about to pass out. Sometimes that happens with dehydration or medication side effects.
I would sometimes wonder, have you started a new medication? Are you on, or have you ever been tested for a thyroid condition? So is this really new, or have you had it before? What's changed in your environment or not? Lots of questions here. We may not have the right answers here, but if you're concerned by it, we would encourage you to come see your doctor. Come see us.
In medical school, one of my lecturers, he told us when we were doing the neuroanatomy and we were talking about the complex circuits, he said it takes an average of 6 visits in order for the average person with vertigo to get an answer. And it really stuck with me of how complex this is, how many different causes there are, and how our ultimate goal is we're working to help somebody to relieve their symptoms. And that there are a lot of things we can do to try to figure out a cause and also to help relieve symptoms in the meantime, because this can be something that can interfere with your entire life while it's happening.
Well, that'll conclude your health today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can send us any questions at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter or Facebook or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host, Dr. Jonathan Fricke, and our guest today, Dr. Travis Langley. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Jonathan Fricke.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.